This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Mind's Eye.
Hello, this is Angel S. with Riverbender, and I hope you are having a wonderful day. Anne Frank once said, "I don't think of all the misery, but of the beauty that still remains." With everything that is happening in our world today, always remember her powerful words. Now let's see what we have going on today. 9 corpses found adrift in a boat off Brazil were likely migrants from Mauritania and Mali, police say. And this is out of the Barcelona Associated Press. Brazilian police investigating the grim discovery of a boat full of corpses say the dead were likely African migrants from Mali and Mauritania. Fishermen off Brazil's northern coastal state of Pará found the boat adrift Saturday in the Atlantic Ocean. Brazil's federal police said in a statement late Monday it had recovered 9 dead in total. Documents and objects found near the bodies indicate that the victims were migrants from the African continent from the region of Mauritania and Mali, the statement read. Police added that other nationalities could be among the deceased. The roughly 12-meter-long white and blue canoe-shaped boat found in Brazil shared the same characteristics of a Mauritanian fishing frequently used by West African migrants and refugees fleeing to Spain's Canary Islands, suggesting Brazil was probably not their destination. The Atlantic route from West Africa to the European Union territory is one of the most dangerous in the world. Boats that miss their destination can be swept away by Atlantic trade winds and currents from east to west, drifting for months. Migrants abroad often die of dehydration and malnutrition. Others have also been known to jump into the ocean out of desperation. An Associated Press investigation published last year revealed that in 2021, at least 7 boats from Northwest Africa had been found in the Caribbean and Brazil, all carrying dead bodies. A 500% spike in migration from the northwest coast of Africa to Spain this year has alarmed European authorities. Despite a 210 million euro deal signed in February between the European Union and Mauritania, the majority of departures have taken place from the West African nation. While more than 13,000 migrants have reached the Canaries so far in 2024, according to Spain's Interior Ministry, hundreds others have been reported missing. In Mauritania, families have even set up a national commission charged with looking for the disappeared migrants. They have been following news of the boat found in Brazil anxiously, according to families who contacted the Associated Press. Brazilian federal police say they are still working to identify the bodies and the cause of death, a difficult task given the advanced state of decomposition they were found in. The latest, Israel must stop settler attacks on Palestinians, United Nations Human Rights Office says, and this is out of the Associated Press. The UN Human Rights Office called on Israeli security forces to immediately end their active participation in and support for attacks by Jewish settlers on Palestinians in the occupied West Bank. The statement Tuesday follows a wave of settler attacks on Palestinian towns and villages in the West Bank, triggered by the killing of a 14-year-old Israeli boy in what authorities say was a militant attack. The Palestinian Health Ministry says 7 Palestinians have been killed by Israeli forces or settlers since the attacks began Friday, and another 75 have been wounded. Israeli authorities have urged people not to resort to vigilante attacks as tensions soar, but rights groups have long accused Israeli forces of routinely ignoring settler attacks or even taking part in them. Tensions in the region have ramped up since the start of the latest Israeli-Hamas war on October 7, when Hamas and Islamic Jihad, 2 militant groups backed by Iran, carried out a devastating cross-border attack that killed 1,200 people in Israel and kidnapped 250 others. Israel responded with an offensive in Gaza that has caused widespread devastation and killed over 33,800 people, according to local health officials. World leaders have urged Israel not to retaliate after Iran launched hundreds of drones and ballistic missiles and cruise missiles over the weekend in an unprecedented revenge mission that pushed the Middle East closer to a region-wide war. The attack happened less than 2 weeks after a suspected Israeli strike in Syria killed two Iranian generals in an Iranian consular building. In Beirut, an Israeli drone strike on a car in southern Lebanon killed one person and wounded two others on Tuesday, state-run national news agency reported. It was not immediately clear if those in the car near the coastal city of Tyre were members of Lebanon's militant Hezbollah group. Shortly before the strike, Hezbollah said it attacked Israel's drone Iron Dome air defense units in the area of Beit Hillel and inflicted casualties. The Israeli military said two armed UAVs crossed from Lebanon into Israel territory and exploded in Beit Hillel. The incident is under review, it said. As a result of the continued evolving situation in Israel, EasyJet has now taken the decision to suspend its flights to Tel Aviv for the remainder of the summer season until October 27th, the company said. Customers booked to fly on this route up this date are being offered options, including a full refund. German airline Lufthansa and on Tuesday resumed flights to and from Tel Aviv, Amman, and Erbil. Flights to Beirut and Tehran remain suspended until at least Thursday. An Iranian official says his country will respond within seconds if Israel seeks to retaliate for its attack over the weekend. Deputy Foreign Minister Ali Bagheri Khani said late Monday that Israel will face a resolute and hard response if it takes further action against Iran. Iran launched hundreds of drones and missiles at Israel over the weekend in response to an apparent Israeli strike on its embassy compound in Syria on April 1st that killed two Iranian generals. With help from the United States, the United Kingdom, Jordan, and other countries, Israel managed to intercept nearly all the projectiles and prevent major casualties or damage. It was the first time Iran has launched a direct military strike on Israel after decades of enmity going back to Iran's 1979 Islamic Revolution. But Bagheri Khani said there will not be a 12 or 13 day gap between a Zionist regime move and Iran's powerful response anymore. The Zionists must now reckon in seconds, not hours. Israel's military chief, Lieutenant General Herzi Halevi, said Monday that his country will respond to the Iranian attack without saying when or how. The United States and other allies of Israel have urged against any further escalation. German Foreign Minister Annalena Baerbock said she will fly to Israel on Tuesday to help de-escalate the tense situation after Iran's weekend attack and expressed Germany's support for Israel. She called on all sides to prevent the conflict from spreading to other countries in the region and for new sanctions against Iran. "I will assure our Israeli partners of Germany's full solidarity," she said, "and we will discuss how a further escalation with more and more violence can be prevented, because what matters now is to put a stop to Iran without encouraging further escalation." Baerbock also said she would use her Tel Aviv visit to again demand that more humanitarian aid be let into Gaza. She also condemned the latest violence in the West Bank, where a 14-year-old Israeli boy was killed in what authorities say was a militant attack, followed by the deaths of seven Palestinians who were killed by Israeli forces or settlers since Friday. The Palestinian Health Ministry says seven Palestinians have been killed by Israeli forces or settlers since the attack began Friday, and another 75 have been wounded. Israeli authorities have urged people not to resort to vigilante attacks as tensions soar, but rights groups have long accused Israeli forces of routinely ignoring settler attacks or even taking part in them. Israel blames civilian casualties on Hamas because the militants fight in dense urban neighborhoods. The military says it has killed over 13,000 militants without providing evidence. Israel withdrew more forces from Gaza earlier this month after wrapping up its offensive in the southern city of Khan Yunis. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has vowed to invade the southernmost city of Rafah, where over half of Gaza's population has sought refuge from fighting elsewhere. The war erupted when Hamas launched a wide-ranging attack into southern Israel on October 7th. Palestinian militants killed some 1,200 people that day and took around 250 hostages. Israelis' offensives have driven driven some 80% of Gaza's population of 2.3 million from their homes and pushed their territory to the brink of famine. Weed killer manufacturer seeks lawmakers' help to squelch claims it failed to warn about cancer. And this is out of the Des Moines Associated Press. Stung by paying billions of dollars for settlements and trials, chemical giant Bayer has been lobbying lawmakers in three states to pass bills providing it a legal shield from lawsuits that claim its popular weed killer Roundup causes cancer. Nearly identical bills introduced in Iowa, Missouri, and Idaho this year, with wording supplied by Bayer, would protect pesticide companies from claims they failed to warn that their product causes cancer if their labels otherwise complied with the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency's regulations. But legal experts warn that legislation could have broader consequences, extending to any product liability claim or, in Iowa's case, providing immunity from lawsuits of any kind. Critics say it could spread nationwide. It's just not good government to give a company immunity for things that they're not telling their consumers, said Matt Clement of Jefferson City, Missouri, attorney who represents people suing Bayer. If they're successful in getting this passed in Missouri, I think they'll be trying to do this all over the country. Bayer describes the legislation as one strategy to address the headwinds it faces. About 167,000 legal claims against Bayer assert Roundup causes a cancer called non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, which Bayer disputes. The company has won some cases, settled many others, but also has suffered several losses in which injuries were awarded and huge initial judgments. It has paid about $10 billion while thousands of claims linger in court. Though some studies associate Roundup's key ingredient with cancer, the EPA has regularly concluded it is not likely to be a carcinogenic to humans. The cost of defending a safe, approved product are unsustainable, said Jess Christensen, head of communications for Bayer's Crop Science Division. The legislation was introduced in targeted states pivotal to Bayer's Roundup operations and is at a different stage in each. It passed the Iowa Senate, is awaiting debate in the Missouri House, and was defended in Idaho, where this year's legislation session ended. Farmers overwhelmingly rely on Roundup, which was introduced 50 years ago, as a more efficient way to control weeds and reduce tilling and soil erosion. For crops like corn, soybeans, and cotton, it's designed to work with genetically modified seeds that resist Roundup's deadly effect. Missouri State Representative Dane Deal, a farmer who worked with Bayer to sponsor the legislation, cited concerns that costly lawsuits could force Bayer to pull Roundup from the U.S. market, leaving farmers to depend on alternative chemicals from China. "This product ultimately is a tool that we need," said Deal, a Republican. Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds, a Republican, said in an email the legislation maintains the integrity of the regulatory process, and without it, Iowa risks losing hundreds of jobs in Muscatine and eastern Iowa City, where Roundup is mostly produced. The Associated Press is seeking public records on Bayer's communications with governors of offices in Iowa, Missouri, and Idaho. Bayer, like other companies, hires lobbyists in states to advocate for its interests. The company backs this legislation in the states where we have a big direct economic impact, Christensen said. Roundup's key ingredient, glyphosate, is derived from phosphate mined in Idaho. And St. Louis is the headquarters of its North America Crop Science Division, acquired in its 2018 purchase of Monsanto. Because of that, many of the lawsuits are filed in Missouri. The five lobbyists registered for Bayer in Iowa and three in Idaho is largely consistent with recent years, but the number working in Missouri this year ballooned from 4 to 9. Lobbyist expenditures exceed $8,000 in Idaho this year. Similar information was not available for Iowa or Missouri. Caitlin Clark and Angel Reese hope to carry over college momentum to the WNBA. And this is out of the New York Associated Press. Caitlin Clark, Angel Reese, and a deep WNBA draft class hope that the momentum they created lifting women's college basketball to new heights carries over to the pros. "We're just not basketball players. We're super impactful to our community, the people around us, the little kids that look up to us, and being able to also be nationwide," Everybody knows us everywhere we go, Reese said Monday night after the Chicago Sky selected the former LSU star with the number 7 pick. Our lives aren't normal. We might get a little bit of normalcy going into the league now, but I'm just excited to be a trailblazer. I'm excited to be part of history and just continue to see the future, and I know it's bright. They'll need to perform on the court for that momentum to continue at the next level and boost the league, which is coming off its own strong year. The WNBA just had its most watched season in 21 years, averaging 462,000 viewers per game across ABC, ESPN, and CBS. The league also had its most watched finals in 20 years, which featured Las Vegas and New York and was won by the Aces. Viewership was up 36% from the previous season. The league's attendance rose 16%, its highest figure since 2018. Throw Clark into the mix and that number could grow exponentially. The potential impact of this draft class wasn't lost on WNBA Commissioner Kathy Engelbert. I would be remiss not to mention the incredible excitement and energy for women's basketball that this group has helped build, she said. It's so clear that this draft class is entering the WNBA at an incredible time. We are witnessing a transformational moment in sports that we may not experience for generations. Clark, who finished her collegiate career as NCAA Division I all-time scoring leader, has helped bring millions of fans to the women's game with her signature shots from the mid-court logo and dazzling passing ability. The Iowa star was a big reason why a record 18.9 million viewers tuned in to the NCAA championship game, with the Hawkeyes lost to unbeaten South Carolina. It's still hard for me to wrap my head around, Clark said of the ratings, which peaked at 24 million viewers for the title game. Clark, who grew up in Iowa, said after being chosen by the Indiana Fever with the number one pick that she was happy to go to another basketball-crazed state. I can't imagine a more perfect fit, a better place for me to start my professional career, an organization that really just believes in women's basketball and wants to do everything the right way, she said. So I couldn't be more excited to get there. The Fever taking Clark had been a foregone conclusion since she announced on February 29th she would turn pro. Nearly 17,000 tickets were claimed to watch the draft at Gainbridge Fieldhouse in Indianapolis, home to the Fever and the NBA's Indiana Pacers. Clark and Cameron Brink, who went number 2 to the Los Angeles Sparks, have said many times that it would be wrong not to honor those who came before them and helped pave the way. I just want to continue the legacy of growing the sport, and I feel like I've said this a lot today, but we really have to look back at the women before us. And I know people keep saying this is a historic draft class, but there were many, many talented draft classes before us, Clark said. I just want to give my props to the Dawn Staleys, Cheryl Swoopes, Lisa Leslies, because they are why I'm here, because I watched them growing up. I just hope that I can continue that legacy for younger girls. He led the Redbirds to great success. Legendary Cardinals skipper Whitey Herzog dies at age 92. And this is by Dan Brannon. The St. Louis Cardinals confirmed Tuesday morning, April 16, 2024, that legendary manager Whitey Herzog has died at the age of 92. Cardinals spokesman Brian Bartow said Tuesday morning the team had been informed of his death by Herzog's family. The team was not sure yet whether it happened Monday night or Tuesday. Herzog had been at Busch Stadium on April 4th for the Cardinals' home opener. Herzog is originally from New Athens, Illinois, and lived in the St. Louis area after his Cardinals career. The entire Cardinals family is heartbroken to learn of the passing of Hall of Famer and World Series champion manager Whitey Herzog at the age of 92, the Cardinals said in a statement. Herzog managed the Cardinals to a World Series championship in 1982 with a dynamic, fast-paced playing style known as Whitey Ball. The team's success continued into the late 1980s, making two more World Series appearances in 1985 and 1987. The Cardinals Nation had this comment about Whitey. It is with a heavy heart that we learn of the passing of former St. Louis Cardinals manager Whitey Herzog. Many of us grew up with Whitey Ball and were blessed with the impacts that he made both on and off the field, forever in our hearts and in our memories. Herzog was inducted into the National Baseball Hall of Fame in 2010 and has 1,281 career managerial wins with the Cardinals, Royals, Rangers, and Angels. After retiring from baseball, Herzog remained at the Cardinals team and said he continued to watch every game. Salman Rushdie's knife is unflinching about his brutal stabbing and uncanny in its vital spirit. And this is out of the New York Associated Press. In Salman Rushdie's first book since the 2022 stabbing that hospitalized him and left him blind in one eye, the author wastes no time reliving the day he thought might be his last. At 10:45 on August 12, 2022, on a sunny Friday morning in upstate New York, I was attacked and almost killed by a young man with a knife just after I came out on stage at the amphitheater in Chautauqua to talk about the importance of keeping writers safe from harm, Rushdie writes in the opening paragraph of the memoir Knife, published Tuesday. At just over 200 pages, Knife is a brief work in the canon of Rushdie, among the most exuberant and expansive of contemporary novelists. Knife is also his first memoir since Joseph Anton, the 2012 publication in which he looked back on the fatwa, the death decree issued more than 20 years earlier by Iran's Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini because of the alleged blasphemy in Rushdie's novel, The Satanic Verses. Rushdie was initially driven into hiding and for years lived under constant protection. But the threat he seemingly receded, and he had for some time been enjoying his preferred life of travel, social engagement, and a free imagination out at play in such recent novels as Quixote and Victory City. As Rushdie observes in Knife, subtitled Meditations After an Attempted Murder, he had sometimes pictured his public assassin turning up. But the timing of the 2022 attack seemed not just startling, but anachronistic. The rising of the murderous ghost from the past, returning to settle a score, Rushdie thought long resolved. He refers to August 11, 2022 as his last innocent evening. But in many ways, Knife is as notable for the spirit it shares with his other books as it is for the blunt and horrifying descriptions of the attack that did and did not change his life. In the book's first chapter, Rushdie praises the pure heroism, the physical courage of the Chautauqua Institution event moderator Henry Reese, who grabbed the assailant. But if another kind of heroism is hope and determination and humor in the wake of trauma, then Knife is a heroic book documenting Rushdie's journey from lying in his own blood to a return to the same stage 13 months later and attaining a state of wounded happiness. Part of the story of Knife is that Rushdie's life, even over these past 2 years, is about more than an act of murderous violence. He dedicates a chapter to meeting and marrying the poet Rachel Eliza Griffiths, who greeted him during a PEN America event in 2017 and revealed a dazzling smile. Rushdie found himself unable to forget that smile. She had been in New York City when she learned of the stabbing and hurried on a private plane to be with him, having been told he was unlikely to survive. "I wasn't dead," Rushdie wrote. "I was in surgery." As Rushdie recovered, he learned that his dear friend and fellow author, Martin Amis, was gravely ill with cancer. Rushdie and Amis were part of a circle of gifted friends from Britain that also included Christopher Hitchens and Ian McGowan. In what proved to be a farewell email, Rushdie praised the generosity and kindness of Amis, encouragement after the knife attack, and celebrated such Amis novels as London Fields and Money. Amis died in May 2023. Rushdie's charged assailant is Haiti Mader, but the author refers to him as the A, short for the ass, or asinine man. He does allow his imagination to expend itself on an unlikely dialogue with the fellow being he knows only through a momentous span of 27 seconds. Why even pretend to speak with his would-be killer? I'm not looking for an apology. I do wonder how he feels now that he has had time to think over things, Rushdie writes. Mader's trial was delayed from January after a judge ruled he was allowed to seek the memoir's manuscript and related materials. He will leave the hospital, grow stronger in body and mind, return to the events he attended so often before, like the annual PEN America Gala. He will feel heartened by supportive messages of world